It's the Noble Ignoble edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Dawkins suppression, religious disorder, and a review of the prizes, both noble and ignoble. Let's begin episode 136.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away from the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your freethinking historian.
And I'm Don, your political science philosopher and occasionally tongue-tied host.
With you again here is Jenna, your biochemist.
So, everybody have a good Thanksgiving?
I didn't really have a Thanksgiving.
Go turkey, go!
Yeah, well, I just...
You're not thankful of things?
I am. I'm dubious heritage, and I'm not a farmer, so I don't really have, you know, I don't have to worship the crop gods and thank them for the harvest.
Aren't you from the prairies?
Yes, and when I was on the prairies, yes, you did go out for what they'd call fall supper or Thanksgiving or both. They have more than one.
Also, do you live a completely holiday-free existence? Because I dare you to try and find one that doesn't have dubious history.
So that might just be a yes. I can't think of any real holiday that I celebrate. I mean, occasionally at Christmas, I will gather with my family.
Blasphemy
Day. Celebrate
my
family.
Blasphemy Day is a holiday for some people.
It's a celebration.
If you take it off work.
So. Yeah. Well, some people do. But anyway, well, my last couple days have been interesting. I received my new CFI membership card in the mail a few days ago.
Well, that just must have made you pleased as punch.
Does that make you a card-carrying skeptic?
Yes, it does. As a matter of fact, it does. The interesting thing about this, though, is that my old membership card had an expiry date of September 9th, 2011, and I renewed my membership around that time, and then a couple days ago, my new card arrived. But a little odd, it had the expiry date of September 20th, 2011.
So what you're saying is that CFI now has a really short cycle period between when you got to get your new membership.
Pretty much have to re-up every 11 days.
Yeah, that's a new policy, I guess they're implementing.
It shows commitment.
Well, actually, obviously, I think this is some kind of error in processing. Nonetheless, a significant one. I hope CFI will correct this at some point. It's a little bit frustrating for me personally because when I was executive director of CFI Vancouver, one of the first things that I was doing in my 3 months or so was trying to fix the membership paperwork. Back then, CFI Canada and CFI Transnational were essentially still the same organization. So every month I would get different sets of data from Toronto, CFI Canada's headquarters, and Amherst, CFI Transnational's headquarters that didn't match up.
And only half of them were in metric.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be too tough, though, on CFI. I mean, okay, it's having trouble getting its paperwork together. And if you compare that to the opposition, in quotes, I guess, something like the church, right, which will tend to run smoother. But they've had a few millennium to get their act together. So I think cutting them a little bit of slack will be good.
Sure. If CFI can fix this in about 1,000 years, I'm pretty happy with that. I mean, I don't know, though. I think when you become a Catholic, the membership card you get signed by the Pope is probably... does that expire? Do you have to renew that every year? I don't know, actually.
Well, it's not so much that it expires, but it will burst into flames the minute you do us in.
Okay. Well, I was going to ask, you know, when it does run out, if it does expire before this oversight is corrected, is there skeptic excommunication?
Possibly.
Does that mean, like, you're going to have to start going to church or some New Age therapy, you know? Are you going to start selling homeopathy on the
whilst
side?
Whilst
getting acupuncture? Some kind of, like, alt-med, like, heathen. I have to have all this, like, stuff all going on at once.
Although that would be an interesting torture for you know, a skeptic, right? You're a lapsed skeptic. Oh, no. The CFI police are going to come, and they're going to force-feed you homeopathic remedies until you convert back to the skeptic way.
Yeah.
Although I feel most skeptics would probably be comfortable with that consequence not having it.
Yeah. No, studying in homeopathy. I mean, yeah, nice refreshing drink. but getting on with today's show, we have a great show today. We're going to be talking about the Nobel Prizes later. But first, some interesting news actually related to CFI in the United States. Richard Dawkins had a planned event for CFI Michigan, but the event was canceled at the last minute. And here are the details. Dawkins was scheduled to speak for CFI Michigan at the Wingate Country Club in Rochester's Hills, which is a suburb of Detroit. However, the booking was canceled when the owners saw an October 5th interview with Dawkins on the O'Reilly Factor, in which Dawkins was discussing his new children's book, The Magic of Reality, How We Know What's Really True. And if you've seen this interview, O'Reilly is going, so you're really promoting your book about atheism to kids? And Dawkins is like, no, it's not what I'm doing at all. But in it, back and forth. Apparently, the owner of this country club was, well, I can't have that. I don't want that in my country club. Canceled the event. And, well, CFI Michigan was pretty pissed off.
Especially since country clubs have so many small children running about.
Yeah, well,
encouraged to attend.
Also, too, I think the most disturbing fact is that this owner seems to listen to O'Reilly on a regular basis. That in itself, I think, would have been a red flag.
Yeah. In a phone call to CFI Michigan executive or assistant director Jennifer Behan, the representatives of the country club explained that the owner did not wish to associate with individuals such as Dawkins or his philosophies. The facility is privately owned, but is open for the public for special events and occasions. So according to Title II of the Federal Civil Rights Law of 1964, open to the public means all persons shall be entitled to the full and equal enjoyment of the goods, services, facilities, privileges, advantages, and accommodations of any place of public accommodation as defined in this section, without discrimination or segregation on the grounds of race, color, religion, or national origin. Ergo, this could be a violation of the civil rights of atheists in Michigan.
Supreme Court?
Well, we'll have to see. I think they get a bit tired of hearing from us atheists all the time. So the sold-out event, which was scheduled for Wednesday, October 12th, is going to be held at a different venue. Nevertheless, though, I mean, it's actually a really good reason why groups like CFI Michigan should exist, because atheists have trouble assembling without offending somebody, apparently.
Yeah. Although, of course, this does lead issues for the libertarian who happen to also be skeptics because, you know, it's their private property. They have absolute right over that. And
well, according to the laws of the land, they don't. Yeah. I mean, if they wanted to say, you know, when Michigan booked this event, if they said no, well, I guess that's fine. But booking it and then canceling it, because the stated purpose of the cancellation is because we don't like your philosophies. I mean, could you imagine if this was a fundamentalist Christian creationism talk and some person said, listen, I don't like your Christian attitude. I'm going to cancel your event. I mean, you would have protests all over the world.
Well, on the other hand, though, I mean, if they had found out partway through the booking that the people were actually doing this in support of the KKK, I doubt that there would be too much of a stink that was raised to cancel the event.
Actually, that's not necessarily, I mean, there probably wouldn't be as much of a stink, that's true. But the American Civil Liberties Society, you know, the people who sue for civil rights, have on more than one occasion gone up for the Nazi Party of the U.S. and all that to defend their civil rights, even though they hold their nose sort of while
they're
doing
it. Right, like legally you can't really draw too much of a distinction, or else all of a sudden we're talking about, you know, legal moral judgments in legal.
Yeah, in
venues.
Fact, one of the most sort of interesting occurrences of this sort of thing, many years ago, a prominent atheist group actually marched in support of a racist organization that wanted to do one of their protests, and on the grounds of free speech and free expression, they actually supported their right. Unfortunately, decimating their own group's cohesion and allegiance to their cause, but
yeah.
Some people would say that was a good thing. Some people say it was a bad thing. I guess it's a matter of choosing your battles.
Well, I know, just to sort of put a polish on this, O'Reilly would say, well, that law, Obama, it's his country, he's a communist, and they're all out to get us.
Yeah, he's also a Nazi, apparently.
Yeah, you gotta like the fascist communist. It's a very interesting schizophrenia.
Yeah, who also hate white people.
Ooh.
Yeah. But let's move on to our next bit of skeptical news.
Speaking of interesting things. So, maybe they are crazy, these sort of religious types. As our listeners may know, I don't read a lot, but I do. I am a massive listener to podcasts and audiobooks. I recently heard on an audiobook on psychology from the teaching company. It was one of the things I was listening to, and they were talking about mental disorders and how often we sort of think of them as a solitary, single sort of disease, but more often than not, they kind of exist on a spectrum, such as autism and, to my surprise, schizophrenia, of which there is a mild version called schizotypal personality disorder. Schizotypal personality disorder is characterized by a need for social isolation, anxiety in social situations, odd behavior and thinking, and often unconventional beliefs. The thing I found interesting about this quote-unquote disorder is that those affected have what is called metamagical thinking, with obsessive belief systems usually around religion or of a religious nature. This is one of those... this is in the same spectrum as schizophrenia, but it's not as disabling, or it doesn't actually disable the person that much, or because unlike schizophrenia, there are no such things as, you know, auditory hallucinations, but they both share sort of an altered view of reality. What you find in schizotypals is this metamagical thinking, a very, very strong interest in something like New Age beliefs, fantasy, religion, and a very concrete, literal form, a very fundamentalist sort of style or thinking. So when somebody says that, you know, someone walked on water, it's not a metaphor. Someone raised from the dead, it's not a metaphor. It is literally, this is what was reported. It is the literal fact. Sound familiar? Some psychological evolutionists, and that is a very controversial field in itself, think that this disorder may have some important evolutionary effects, notably in the early development of religion via shamanism. The critical thing with schizotypal shamanism, as it's called, is that it's not uncontrolled in the way schizophrenia proper is. So you don't have somebody babbling tongues in the middle of a hunt or somebody sitting there hearing voices, you know, at the same time. It's a milder voice, a milder version. So when they do sort of their talking in tongues, it's at the right time during a ceremony. And when they hear voices, it's when everyone's sort of somber and in the mood for this sort of thing. The passion of their beliefs allow for these individuals to provide sort of a focal point for tribal culture, or again, so this sort of theory goes, and their willingness for their beliefs to endure hardships and to show mental and physical discipline help these individuals gain a certain respect within the social group. In a sort of odd sort of way, their isolation kind of helps them from not being a burden on the group, so they tend to be off by themselves. Their absence from dangerous work, like the hunt and that sort of thing, means they have a greater chance of surviving to a ripe old age. And because they do sort of have this reverence in the community, it helps them sort of propagate their damaged genes. Thus, one possible explanation for the prevalence of religion in culture is the reproductive success of these genetically linked disorders in the human genome.
So I think that, I mean, talking about things as a spectrum really makes a lot of sense. But I do take a bit of issue with your interpretation of this, you know, sort of quality of these people's genes. So one thing I think is important to keep in mind when we're talking about order and disorder when it comes to mental processing is that all of our thoughts and all of our perception of the world and our rational thinking and our irrational thinking are all the result of effectively the exact same machinery. I mean, our neurons respond to chemical neurotransmitter signals and fire themselves, you know. And this sort of everything, all the neurons working together is what gives us our entire perception of reality and our whole worldview and our processes and thinking and philosophies and everything else.
But I think you would agree, sorry, just to go on that one point,
yeah,
that someone who has full-fledged schizophrenia and they hear voices that aren't really there, that is, this machinery is not running the way it's supposed to, that there is something broken as opposed to how it was sort of, and I hate to use this word, as it sort of evolved to function.
Well, and I
thought I was going to use the D word, weren't you?
I think that, I mean, it's kind of, there are certain things that are very, we humans like order and and patterns and whatnot. And so when something doesn't fit into the way that we think it, quote unquote, should be, that's considered wrong or malfunctioning. But in this type of context, I actually don't think biologically it's necessarily malfunctioning so much as functioning differently. And evolution really is a spectrum. And yeah, things might be functioning differently in a schizophrenic such that signals that would normally not be perceived as actual auditory signals are being perceived as such. And in the society we live in and the way that we're, you know, trying to function, this is a disadvantage. But to call it wrong functioning seems a little off to me.
Well, I think part of it, I mean, I'm not going to disagree totally because it's a spectrum,
yeah,
right? You know, it kind of goes from black to gray to white, whereas white is socially acceptable. And at what point socially acceptable becomes you're actually broken along this scale is questionable at best, right? So again, somebody who has a vivid imagination, well, at what point does a vivid imagination become delusional?
Exactly.
It's hard to point that place down.
In some physical disorders, it becomes a lot easier to tell when something is actually a dysfunction. So, you know, if your heart works in such a way that it destroys itself over time and then ceases to work, that's clearly a dysfunctional thing that is, you know, is detrimental to the organism. But when we're talking about mental, like you're saying, quote unquote, disorders, the context for that is much more societal than biological. And most of the time, things are diagnosed in a symptom-based, and by symptom, I mean behavioral-based way rather than something that we're actually able to measure in the body.
Occasionally,
you know, that's not true, but often.
Actually, no. I think one of the things that I was thinking about this the second time, right, is on the one hand, I can agree as an individual, you may say damage, not damage genes. But there's another aspect that's on this is the idea of the social animal, as
yeah.
in humans, this particular disorder, right? And it is registered as a disorder.
Yep.
But this
as are so many things.
Yes. Yes. But one of the things, according to this theory of evolutionary psychology, the reason why this sort of had an opportunity to proliferate is because it existed in a social context where it became an advantage, at least for the minor, the occasional individual to exhibit these traits. And that, as you sort of point out, the evolutionary advantages now, and I think more and more as our society becomes more complex,
mm-hmm.
of these sort of socio-biological oddities become more prevalent, more important. So again, if someone who's schizophrenic, full-blown hallucinatory, if you did that a million years ago, you were dead. But today, it actually has the opportunity to, you can live with that, and in such a way, especially with the right medication, you have this altered perception of reality, but you can still change the way society itself can look at itself because you
yeah.
have this unique perspective that normally wouldn't have been able to coexist.
And perhaps the other way as well, like for the schizotypal characteristics that at some point, like you were saying, really were adventitious for the individual to stay alive might now be losing prevalence and those people might become more social pariahs than really able to pass on those genes.
Well, that may be all true, but I still think that the next time you see a fundamentalist, a Bible literalist, or a New Age zealot, remember, they may not be wrong. They may literally just be mentally ill.
Well, well said there, Don. Let's go to a commercial break, and we'll be back with more after this on Radio Free Thinker.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Thank you. is the best tool ever devised for understanding how the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at radiofreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Empowers you. We're back on Radio Free Thinker. So, Jenna.
Yeah, well, we've been talking a little bit in the last segment about, you know, stereotyping of people based on certain, you know, mental traits that we might have. But to take things in a little bit of a different direction, let's talk a little bit about the stereotyping that we use all the time in biological research. So when I say E. coli, if you are an average member of the public, or maybe an above average or below average, but you know, a typical member of the public, you might think of a bacteria in terms of some really nasty food poisoning and warnings about spinach and strawberries and sprouts. However, for people like me who are something of a, you know, a microbiological bend, I know that E. coli is the most studied bacterium on the globe and possibly the organism we know most about on Earth. We have studied this little thing and continue to do so just with incredible energy. So what's important to remember that all of this knowledge that we've generated isn't actually about E. coli or Escherichia coli, but actually a very specific strain of this bacterium called K12. So in science, we accept certain limitations. You can't study everything. So in biology and in microbiology, you tend to use model organisms. And what these are defined species that most researchers concentrate their studies on so everyone can talk about the same thing, or else we're all wandering around sort of talking tangentially to each other. It is useful, however, to remember that when you're studying a nematode, which is a worm, you're not actually studying worms. You're studying a nematode. And when you're studying a mouse, it might be your model organism, but you're not studying mammals. You're studying a mouse. And obviously, it's important to keep this in mind when drawing conclusions about the implications of that research. So this is exactly why there is so much controversy both inside and outside scientific fields about animal drug testing and its value, because a mouse isn't a human, it's a mouse. However, in the bacterial world, there is even more diversity. It is crazy. There are way more species of bacteria than of animals. And it's good to sometimes take a look at just how wide a spectrum we are literally distilling down into a single point by concentrating on this one organism. So I was just at a talk just this afternoon by Eric Denimer, who studies the diversity and lifestyles of E. coli from around the world and how this relates to their different genetic makeup. So as a little bit of background, I mentioned that we tend to study the K12 strain of E. coli. And this was isolated from the feces, poop, of a single convalescent diphtheria patient in the early 20th century. And again, this single strain is our basis for a heck of a lot of knowledge about what we know about bacteria in general. E. coli does, however, had a much wider genetic and phenotypic range than this. So just a bit of background, the primary habitat for E. coli is as a commensal organism in the intestines of vertebrates. So this means that they live with us without really causing us any problem, and they do that for birds and pigs and lots of other animals. And they can also live in their secondary habitat, which is in fresh water and sediment. So you can see how these type of lifestyles are fairly distinct from that single situation in which our model organism was isolated, which is someone that it was making sick. So all of this diversity in the way that they live, it really makes sense. Oh, well, it makes sense that their secondary lifestyle is in the ground when what is in your intestine tends to end up
when you say
on
secondary.
The ground. Yep.
So you mean they prefer to live in your stomach?
If we're going to anthropomorphize, yes.
Yes, and but they also either have part of their life cycle or they can subsist outside of for a while, but it's not their preferred environment. Or...
Yeah, well, that's sort of what I was trying to say and failing, is that it makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you're going to live in one host in their intestine, to get to another host, you pretty much are going to go on the ground or in the water. That's where stuff from your intestine goes. And so there's no, most of the time, direct fecal to oral route to have a, you know, transmission to a new host without hitting the ground.
Pause for a moment for any joke that may come to mind.
Well, what about if, like, you get eaten by a bigger predator? A really big predator.
Wouldn't even have to be that big. Okay, there is a direct route. I lie. Okay. Yeah, no, vertebrate to vertebrate. So it absolutely could happen in larger mammalian predators. Yes, that is very true. So studies conducted by Professor Denimer, as I was saying, show that to go along with all this ecological diversity, the single species E. coli also has massive genetic diversity. So depending on the strain, each bacterium can have between 4,300 and 5,300 genes. So that's not even sort of different genes or variations on the same. Like they can have a completely, like up to 1,000 genes total different from each other.
Out of how many, roughly?
That's their total numbers, between 4,300 and 5,300. So some might have 1,000 genes total less than their neighbor. And of these genes, there are less than 2,000 that are actually conserved across all of them, that are common to all of them, which leaves another over 2,000, 2,000 to 3,000 that actually differ. And again, not just in you know, what you might call single nucleotide polymorphisms, or which are sort of small differences in the same gene, or even sort of different versions of the same protein. These are completely different things that these bacteria express.
But this is all junk DNA. We all know about that. Junk DNA doesn't mean anything.
Junk DNA doesn't make proteins. These are actually genes that each encode for a protein. So each of these could potentially be expressed by the bacterium during some time in its life.
And relating to a story you did before, so this is the idea that we don't know about a lot of different species, but this one particular species, we're learning everything we possibly can, including this genetic diversity.
Well, no, because when we talk about learning everything we can, we're actually looking at only one member of this diversity. So this one strain that we look at is one representative of this one species, which is one representative of this entire huge field of diversity when it comes to bacteria. So we're basically using this one species to extrapolate all the things we know, or many of the things we know, about all kinds of different species. So as might be expected, Denimer's lab also found that the different genotypes, or the different genetic diversity that's there, is correlated with different niches in environment. So, for example, almost half of all people sampled from the U.S. are carriers of a specific strain, whereas in a jungle in Africa, less than 2% of people had the same strain. And there are also different profiles from birds than in humans, although they can live in both. And different levels of pathogenicity, or you know, ways that it makes you sick in the different strains. And some kill mice and some don't. And it's all sort of like the lifestyle of the different bacteria correlate with the genotype, which is all, of course, a product of evolution and natural selection and totally expected. But why am I talking about this? So scientific and specifically biological models, like we were saying, are one of the most valuable tools that we can use to have each individual study actually contribute to an advancing larger field, as opposed to being really sort of punctate individual studies. And it's a good idea, however, to do studies like this one that's happening in France right now, to effectively take a skeptical look at the applicability of the biological models by getting a handle on what you actually don't know. So having a better idea of the diversity of the group that you're using one member to represent allows us to more rationally draw conclusions about the group as a whole. Otherwise, we're just poking around in the dark.
So what... To put my simplified summation, we know a heck of a lot about one particular variation of the theme, but if the more we learn about the variations outside of that particular one, the more we learn about the whole thing in contrast.
The more we know the better we're able to evaluate how much of what we know about the one thing we can actually apply to everything else.
Excellent.
Wow.
That's science.
All right, then. Well, let's get into the laboratory and put some mice through some mazes, then.
Oh, that's good, but we weren't talking about mice.
I know, but I like mice.
We were talking about mammals.
Well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker. We'll be back after this.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
In the sky, standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Yeah, the state of hip-hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now, hip-hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting, like, more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle, let the clatter kill him, let the cataclysm wash. Who really listens? Precision with a verse draws a crowd. I draw a line between an easy melody and peace of mind.
Uh-huh. You got DJs doing all kind of crazy shit on the turntables. I like where it's going, and I like, you know what I'm saying, the creative process that brothers is trying to take it to right now.
Rally Rails and Brendan Butter in the place to be. Crimes and Treasons Radio, 101.9 FM, Vancouver. CITR.ca, every Tuesday, 9 till 11.
Dynamite!
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker. So we're going to be talking about the Nobel Prizes.
Yes, it's a minor thing that some people may or may not have heard about. The Nobel Prizes were given out for chemistry, physics, medicine, peace, and literature. Just in case for those people who aren't aware, the prizes were set up by Alfred Nobel, the inventor of dynamite, in an effort to make penance for the harm his invention had done to society, or so legend has it. Each award is about $1.5 million. The prize for economics is technically not a Nobel Prize, but a prize offered in, quote, the memory of Alfred Nobel, and is actually awarded by the Bank of Sweden. So, for the real Nobels, the award for chemistry went to Daniel Steckmann for the discovery of quasi-crystals, which really struck me as something that Deepak Chopra would be selling or something. I mean, he must be on this somewhere. It is the non-repeating ordered pattern of atoms that were once thought impossible. When we think of crystals, in fact, the common sense definition of crystals is a regular repeating pattern of atoms or molecules, like a diamond or something like that. What Steckmann discovered that if you rapidly cooled a metal in a very particular way, you get a crystal-like structure that lacks any repeating pattern. In fact, a number of the stories I read made allusions to a particular kind of Arabic art that are on, like, buildings and all that, that sort of show this non-repeating pattern. I mean, it's not a pattern. You look at it, and your eyes strain to find a pattern in it, which is why it's kind of intriguing. But there is no repeating pattern. It's in a way, sort of randomized order. As I said, this apparently non-repeating structure was deemed to be impossible, and it took Steckmann many years for anyone to take him seriously. In fact, he'd lost jobs because people said, no, you're nuts. Noted multiple Nobel laureate Linus Pauling once stated that Steckmann was talking nonsense, and that, quote, there is no such thing as quasi-crystals, only quasi-scientists, which now he must be sitting there going,
That is a good put-down.
Fighting words.
So that was kind of interesting. I kind of like that story because, again, it shows you that, you know, if the science is behind you and you have the perseverance, the science always wins out, even if you go against what everyone else believes in, right? If the science is true, it wins out in the end. It may take some time, but it's it, yeah. Speaking of going against the wind, the award for physics, actually a trio won for this one, and they discovered that the universe is expanding at an accelerating rate. This also flew in the face of accepted theory at the time, but now has led to the discovery of what is called dark energy. It's the force that is supposed to be responsible for this accelerated expansion. So at one point, everyone was worried about what's called the Big Crunch, that, you know, the universe will expand from the Big Bang, which may or may not have happened, and that at some point it'll lose energy and gravity will pull everything back into a singularity again. But because of this discovery of this sort of repellent force, it's now believed that we're actually going to have the big, there's a word for it, I can't remember.
Is it called the Big?
Yeah, it's called the Big, and it's like, you know, when you blow out a match or something, right? The big snuff out or something like that, right?
Big snuff.
Where
not things to be will confused with tobacco.
Will just become more and more dissipated, and eventually everything will just sort of go to a ground state of zero.
So not with a bang, but with a whisper kind of end.
Yes. In fact, one of the interesting things that also came about this is that this dark energy apparently accounts for 73% of the universe. That's when you calculate matter and energy as sort of one sum total. And that the dark matter accounts for about 22%, and regular matter accounts for about 5%. Now, of course, if that doesn't make you feel small enough as it is, of that 5%, that is what we call regular matter, 4% of it is intergalactic gas. And the stuff of the universe, you know, stars, planets, black holes, you and me, well, that only accounts for less than 1%.
So I'm totally universe, dark matter. I don't know about you.
Well, you know, this one, I mean, outside again, you know, Einstein once had his cosmological constant, which the math said should be there. And he said, no, I screwed up. And this cosmological constant was supposed to be the expansion factor. But it turns out that he was right. But I like the whole part that we account for less than 1%, which means in one sense we're kind of special because we're very unique. But
and if by you had we, some form you don't of, mean we. You mean non-gaseous regular matter.
I mean we as in a group of regular mattered items. So I am taking the tribal identity and warping it a bit, but it still qualifies.
But I'll give it to you.
But again, I mean, the whole idea that, you know, if there is such a thing as a deity or a god, that he would really care about what amounts to. I mean, okay, 1% is real matter. How much of that real matter is humanity compared to the whole grand scheme of things, mm-hmm. right? I mean, you'd have to be a deity in order to even know what that was. The other one was award for medicine. Again, another trio won for their mechanism about static immune response. This had one interesting twist, is that one member, Canada's own Ralph Steinman, who discovered how the static immune system triggers the adaptive immune system, died the day prior to the awarding of the prize. However, the awards committee wasn't aware of this. Now, the Nobel Prize Committee has actually a very strict rule about not giving out awards posthumously.
Also about not giving them to more than three people, hence the trios.
Oh.
Continue.
So when it was announced that he had won, and then the committee had found out, oh, but he's dead, they went through the little powwow thing, and they had, what are we going to do? And eventually they said, well, okay, we're going to continue with the award. He gets the award, because at the time we made the decision, we thought he was alive, which I guess means Jimmy Hoffa still could, in theory, win, because they don't know he's dead. Yeah, okay, I won't go there.
The funny thing about this, Don, that I heard was that if they hadn't given him the award, most of us never would have known that he died. And here he is, a great scientist in Canada.
Yeah.
So, in a way, it kind of, I mean, it's tragic for him, but it allowed us to learn about all his work and stuff. So.
Well, and also showed how interesting things can be interconnected, because he was using his own research to help treat the cancer that he was suffering from. Or, again, that's what's been reported. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's so interesting how science can sometimes weave its stories. Another interesting one, and the last one that I'm going to mention, is the about the Nobel Prizes, is the Award for Peace, which again was awarded to a trio of women for their nonviolent struggle for the safety of women and for women's rights to full participation in peaceful building work. During this report, obviously enough, a lot of press was given the fact that these were actually three women who were chosen, and rightfully so. But I thought it was also interesting to go back and take a look at who has won the award based on their gender. As it turns out...
Wait, people win Nobel Prizes based on their gender?
No, but you can do an analysis of those who have won based on their gender. If you were a proper scientist, you would understand how we can do these reinterpret... Yeah.
How many ladies have picked up the prize, Don?
In the history of the Peace Prize, there have been 15 female winners of the Peace Prize out of 101 recipients. And, of course, I'm not going to include organizations like the Red Cross or the UN. These are just real human beings, people. It should be noted, for reference, the prize for physics, there were 191 winners. Out of that, only two were women. For chemistry, there were 160 winners, four women. For medicine, 199 winners, 10 women. Literature, 108 winners, 12 women. And lastly, and leastly, is economics. And again, I don't really think this is a real Nobel Prize, but just for reference. There have been 69 winners and only one woman in that particular thing. So there's been a grand total of 45 women Nobel laureates versus 786 male laureates. That said, out of the four people who won multiple awards, and there's only been four who've ever won more than one award, one of them was a woman, Marie Curie, and she actually has another interesting distinction that I thought. Of the four people, two of them won twice in their field. So one guy won twice in physics, one guy won twice in chemistry. One, as we mentioned before, Linus Pauling, he won one for, I think it was chemistry, and one for Peace Prize. But Marie Curie is the only one to win twice in two scientific categories, once for chemistry and once for physics. I thought that was interesting.
I have a question.
You in the front row.
Yes. So if only 45 women have won compared to the 786, why is that? Is that because the...
Well, before the show, you were saying
bias
that
against women?
It reflects the gender dichotomy in society that there are roughly 7 men for every 0.4 women.
Yeah.
This is one of those times when you sit there and you say, well, women represent 50% of the population roughly, right? Plus or minus 1% or so. So you would expect them to have at least a relatively proportional representation in the activities of humanity in general. This shows that either, one, you adhere to the theory that women are somehow intellectually inferior, which, again, because of the number of awards that have been won, sort of disproves that there's any biological basis for this sort of discrepancy. But it does show greatly a cultural discrepancy. In fact, you can find a similar discrepancy, I was amazed to find out, for country of origin. If you are a German or an American, you have a significantly higher chance of being a Nobel laureate than you are if you are anybody else.
So then...
I feel that we have to... Sorry, I have my head too full of thoughts as far as women not being represented. And I don't necessarily think it's not fairly represented, although, of course, a lot of women's contributions to the sciences specifically have been sort of overshadowed by either husbands or supervisors who are then, just sort of putting their name second. But I think that we should really delve into this in a future topic as far as some of the motivational differences for men and women continuing on to become leaders in their field in some of the more academic pursuits and the types of sacrifices and societal stigmas that that involves.
Well, it's also interesting, too, that almost half of the women who won Nobel Prizes did so in sort of the arts, right, in literature and Peace Prize, as compared to, quote-unquote, the real sciences, which, again, I think has more of a reflection of our cultural biases than anything else. But speaking of interesting things to study, there's also the Ig Nobel Awards that went on. This year is an American parody of the Nobel Prizes and are given each year in early October for 10 unusual or trivial achievements in scientific research. The stated aim of the prize is to, quote, first make people laugh and then make them think. It is organized by the scientific humor magazine Annals of Improbable Research. And they are presented usually by a bunch of real Nobel laureates. They will give a talk usually on their topic that had won them the prize. This is one of those things, I think it almost at first came out to be sort of, let's make fun of these people who are doing sort of stupid research.
Mm-hmm.
But now has become almost a badge of honor. So if you win an Ig Nobel, that's like, wow, you won an Ig Nobel. You must be someone kind of cool, right?
I love it too, because it's sort of, you know, a lot of research that goes on that's very, very legitimate research, as I'm pretty sure most of these laureates are, is looked at as stupid by people that don't necessarily understand the whole context of the field. And I think, again, that make them laugh, make them think, it acknowledges, you know, and makes people think of research that might seem counterintuitive at first, but could have real value.
I remember reading, I can't remember if it was in Demon Haunted World or Billions and Billions, Carl Sagan was talking about scientists whose research was like a really sort of niche, kind of mundane thing. And even when they sort of made these their discoveries, they didn't realize that that discovery would lead to major advancements
in unrelated fields.
And it was pretty, it was a great chapter, and I will have to look that up for the show notes or something, because it kind of speaks exactly to this sort of point of the Ig Nobel Prizes.
You know, and again, we're only going to focus on a couple of the winners here, but if you go to their website, and I guess we'll have that on our show notes, again, it's amazing the diversity of who would ever have thought of doing research into the wasabi alarm, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, this is one of the ones we're not going to talk about, but I mean, that's someone on the
You've
spectrum.
You've wet my intellectual appetite.
That's someone on the spectrum of disorders that is probably in the very gray area. one of the winners is the winner for biology, and it's interesting to note that the categories are not fixed. So they pick out the 10 best, but they kind of pigeonhole them into a category. So it's not like in the Nobel Prizes where they have, you know, physics, chemistry, medicine, peace, and literature, and those are fixed categories. This is, let's find 10 really cool sort of research projects and then put them into some category. So there's no fixed set of categories. The one for biology, though, was done by Daryl Gwain and Associates for discovering that a certain kind of beetle mates with a certain kind of Australian beer bottle, the stubby, for those older Canadians who remember them. One site was talking about this, saying bugs get it on with bottles. But it's one of those things, again, that kind of makes you think after you go through the first laughter, because the real science behind this is something called superstimulation or supernormal stimulation. Now, you may ask, what is supernormal stimulation? It's essentially an exaggerated version of a stimulus to which there is an existing response to, or a stimulus that elicits a response much more strongly than whatever it was originally intended for in nature. So, for example, a moth will spiral into a flame because it's adapted to navigate by the sun. It thinks, hey, there's a really bright sun, I'm going to go towards it because that's what its natural instinct is for. When it comes to things like eggs, right, there are certain birds that will prefer an artificial version of their own egg. I've actually seen videos of where they're exploiting this, where they will have an egg so big and it's, you know, the right kind of blue or whatever, that the bird can't even get on it, but it's trying to incubate this, like, ginormous sort of egg. More closer to home, junk food. I mean, a lot of junk food is intended to overstimulate our natural responses for things in a sort of perverse sort of way. So the example actually in question was this Australian beetle whose males are attracted to a round, large, orange shape. That's the shape of the females. And so when they saw these beer bottles, they kind of, it's kind of like for the typical male out there. I imagine someone who has like what's a big number for
We'll 66. We'll talk on some D's. Just drop the D's.
Okay, a 66 D. I don't know.
That would just be unreasonable.
But that's the whole point. That's the whole point. If you look at anime, actually, here's a good example. Anime, the huge eyes that they have on anime, right? Those are inhuman eyes.
Yeah.
Barbie has an inhuman length of her leg to body ratio is unnatural.
Yeah.
But it tweaks one of our natural stimulations, and we find it very appealing or attractive, or we're drawn to it because of this evolutionary instinct that's built into us. Unfortunately, the downside to this is that, again, for these male beetles who are getting it on with the beer bottles, is they're no longer getting on with the females of their species, because the females just can't compete with these, in beetle terms, sexy bottles. So there's actually a risk that these beetles could, in some sense, become extinct because they're having sex with an inanimate object.
I was actually hearing it. It's becoming a similar thing in Japan. It's becoming sort of a problem with humans. With guys going after body pillows with women silkscreened onto them because they don't cost money and they don't talk back and they don't need gifts. And people have legally married their body pillows, and it's actually becoming hard for some Japanese women to find a date because men just aren't interested in the real women anymore. They're not.
So, for the record, you are saying that women have a natural instinct to talk, to spend, and to annoy males. And that a natural male response to this is to select people who minimize this negative trait.
It is so a two-way street.
Another winner is in medicine by Marjim Turk et al. There's like 50 people in this one who won.
Apparently the Ig Nobles give out to more than just three.
Well, they give out to whoever wrote the article. It's usually based on an article. So, yeah. And you,
as opposed to a life's work.
And I'm sure in your own career, you have articles where the attributing authors are longer than the story itself. No, okay, that's just me being...
Thanks, Don. Hitting below the scientific belts.
So what they did is they demonstrated that people make better decisions of some kinds of things, but worse decisions of other kinds of things when they have a strong urge to urinate. So if you have to pee, it alters your thinking process, which I would sit there and go, duh, I've had this strong urge to pee, and I know my decisions have been definitely altered as to at least my priorities. But the takeaway that they got from this is the idea of impulse suppression. So essentially, you're trying to suppress the pee, and that they
desperately
believe, yes, that they believe on occasion that they believe that this suppressing of one urge somehow seeps over to other areas, making suppression in other areas easier. One of the examples that they use is something called the Stroop effect. The Stroop effect essentially demonstrates that, it's a reaction time sort of test. So when we see the name of a color, blue, green, or red, that's printed in a color that is not the same as the name. So if I have the word red, but it's in the color blue, naming the color of the word takes a lot longer and is a lot more prone to errors because of the way it sort of works in our own psychology. So we're going to do a quick little test here.
Oh, my.
Yes.
I wasn't informed there would be a quiz.
Actually, you get to do the clock part. Ethan, nice. You're going to look at four words here.
Okay.
Okay.
Careful, men are colorblind.
This is the neutral state. So, tell me the four colors.
Purple.
And remember, we want the color of the text, not what the word itself says.
Okay, so purple, yellow, red, blue, green.
Right.
3 seconds.
So, the words themselves were purple, yellow, red, green, blue.
That's
okay,
right.
Next test. This is not a color one. So, these are five names. What's the color of the text?
Color of the text, red, blue, yellow, green, purple.
Okay.
3 seconds.
Now we're going to do the money one. Color of the text.
Blue, green, purple, yellow, red.
4 seconds.
Okay, and he practiced this before. Actually, you did a lot better than, even if you know what the effect is supposed to be.
If you don't think about it very much, if you just take your first instinct, you can go faster through it.
No. Actually, you're wrong.
Really?
That may be how you've rationalized it, and that's fair. But apparently what's going on is you have different parts of your brain, doing different functions. And they're interfering, which is why you tend to get the delay. But actually, our ability to look at a word and know what that word means is automatic. I won't say it's instinctual, but we do that without even thinking. It's part of our brain. But the other part of our brain that looks at the color of the text and then assigns it to the word red, so I see the color red and I find the word red and I associate with that, that's not as instinctual, it's not as automatic, it actually takes require. So when we're trying to do that, we have to shut out the automatic part that says, oh, the word, there's the word, oh no, I don't want the word, I don't want the name of the word, I want the color of the word. So actually, and this is some interesting things, because it's actually used to help identify a number of spectrum disorders. Okay, it's not spectrum disorders, just disorders, such as...
Which probably exist on a spectrum.
ADHD, schizophrenia.
Oh, yes.
Addiction and depression.
Yes,
and
yes.
And, of course, the delay obviously is greater because of disorder. Speaking of disorders.
And he looks at me.
So the last one we'll probably cover today is In Psychology by Carl Tragen, for trying to understand why in everyday life people sigh. So is a sigh just breath or is it a communication? The tests were actually kind of cool and weird. And it seems strange that no one has really sort of investigated this. I mean, we all sigh and you think, well, why do we sigh? The first test they did was to ask people what word they would associate with a sigh. The participants predicted that a sigh would result from things like frustration, boredom, irritation, as well as some from like relief and of love. Ah, sort of things, right? So they were sort of mixed between positive and negative, but most of them sort of were associated with negative situations. The next thing they tried to do is to see when people sighed. So they were given sort of four scenarios of increasing isolation. In public, sighs were perceived as sort of frustration or irritations, while if someone was sighing in private, it was viewed as an expression of sadness. When asked if there was a difference between self-sighing, i.e. when I sigh, what does it mean, versus when someone else other sighs, almost always the people would say that other people sigh because of sadness, but I sigh because of frustration. However, are still associated with sort of negative situations, but they don't seem to be part of negative communication. So we do it not because we're trying to communicate our frustration, but it's almost like something in us is trying to get its way out.
It seems to have some real empathetic implications from what you've been discussing as far as, you know, recognizing sadness and that kind of thing in other people.
Well, that was kind of what they were thinking. The last test they did was that, you know, if we sigh out of exasperation or frustration, right, it should be relatively easy if you put someone in a frustrating situation to make them sigh. And that's what they found. They found that 77% of participants who were sort of given this really frustrating sort of game puzzle thing to do would sigh. In fact, one of the ones, which was, I thought, hilarious, one of the participants apparently actually said the word sigh instead of actually sighing. That's just, I thought, was
like
hilarious.
A Charlie Brown like comic book or something.
Exactly.
I don't know, Ethan. I'm pretty sure I've heard you do that.
How focused were they on determining what's a sigh and what's like a groan? Because sometimes you go sigh and sometimes you go ugh.
Right.
So what's the difference?
That wasn't mentioned in the article. In fact, do you know what the conclusion was? There is no conclusion.
Oh, okay.
As it turns out, Tegan, who is a professor, was not actually out to investigate any real area. What he did this as a sort of a way to show grad students that there are a lot of areas that are not well studied. As in, you're grad students, what you wanted to do as your thesis paper, there's so many different things you can do. Don't limit yourself to what is sort of traditional alleys to go down.
And some like sighing that are actually pretty ubiquitous in our lives, but not necessarily that well understood.
Well, actually, since this paper was released, a group of psychophysiologist researchers in Belgium did actually a much more rigorous study of sighs, and they came to the conclusion that sighs are actually a way of resetting or normalizing the breathing process that often gets out of sync or whatever because of stress. So we become stressful.
Were these physiologists?
Psychophysiologists.
I wonder what a group of anthropologists would have found.
Well, that's an interesting question. You should do that. You're not an anthropologist.
No, Ethan, no way.
You're almost an anthropologist.
Almost
an
anthropologist?
Well, you're in history. History is close to anthropology.
Okay.
But essentially what the more regular scientific experiments say, we sigh because it sort of makes us feel better. It sort of helps us reset our breathing when we are in a frustrated situation. So I sort of saved this last one for the last because I think it helps us remind us that unlike the Nobel Prize, the Ig Nobel Prizes are largely for fun. I mean, they are a way to look at science in a way that is sort of, oh, not all science is super serious, and we can actually have fun while doing science. And I thought that was a very positive sort of message for them to bring forward.
Absolutely. Excellent.
Very good.
Talking about engaging people.
Totally. Well, we're running out of time here on Radio Free Thinker, so why don't we go to our skeptical highlights. Jenna, go first.
Okay, so I hate to tell you guys, but it's fall. I've learned this. I bicycle, and it is fall, and the wind is up, and the bugs are ready to fly. So I know I've noticed in my building that they've started rolling out the hand sanitizer dispensers, and I'm about to start avoiding toddlers like the plague, but it's also this time of year that we make choices about antibiotic use. And to make these choices in an informed and rational and responsible way, it's good to be informed. So you can check out my latest blog post on And That's Science, and some of the underlying principles of antibiotic effectiveness and resistance are there. And that can be found at andthatscience.ca.
And you're doing a talk for Cafe Sci coming up?
I am. Not next Tuesday, but the next Tuesday.
I believe that's Tuesday, October the 25th.
Yes.
At the Railway Club?
Yeah, I'll be talking about some of the research that I am currently writing up as part of my doctoral thesis.
Great. And that's at 7:30.
7:30 at the Railway Club downtown.
And it coincides with the Skeptics in the Pub that night. So come on out, hear Jenna's talk, socialize, have some drinks, and it'll be a great fun time.
I'll plug it again next week.
What was the date?
The 25th of October.
What time?
7:30.
I forget. Where was it again?
It's at the Railway Club, downtown Vancouver.
Okay.
Those in Kamloops, you're welcome to come.
Yeah, totally.
I have a minor one here. It's a major, but it's a minor one. It's last week I talked about Occupy Wall Street, and this is Occupy Howe Street. So there's sort of like this major uprising going on in the U.S., and they're trying to sort of move it out. So it seems that because I mentioned it on our radio show, and again, our show is such an influential element in our society here, that I've been hearing rumors that they're organizing an Occupy Howe Street down here in Vancouver, in sympathy with this Occupy Wall Street. The event itself is supposed to go on at the lawn of the art gallery on Saturday around noon. Again, this is still sort of rumor. I'm trying to find local labor groups are supposed to be organizing this, and I haven't really been able to find it, but I think it'd be a wonderful thing to try and do for ourselves, especially in light, it's rumored that the conservative government is going to legislate the airline hostesses to go back to work, even though it's a private company, it's a private dispute, but if it's labor involved, there seems to be a bad thing with that associated, especially in the government, but that's just something interesting.
Cool. Well, I have an event to plug, and this is a free lecture with Dr. Jessica Tracy called Death in Science. It is presented by the Freethinkers at UBC and the BC Humanists. The event is Monday, October 24th in Woodward Room 6 at 6:30 here at UBC. The event is with Dr. Tracy, Death in Science, the Existential Underpinnings of Belief in Intelligent Design and Discomfort with Evolution. So it sounds very interesting and complicated. So come check it out. It's free, and it sounds like a lot of fun. So come up for that. In the meantime, this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
And this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
Jenna, the real world is amazing.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full.